It's 7 minutes past seven, and you're welcome to Castlebar this morning ahead of the general election. We're in the front window of the TF Royal Hotel and Theatre, just across the road from the hospital. It's dark, wet and very cold outside. There's a covering of sleet on the cars and the roads. Our guests will have to wrap up and put their heads down to get here to talk all about the issues that people in Mayo will use to choose their TDs on Saturday the 8th of February. Plenty to discuss between now and nine, but first with a look at what it says in the papers. Here's John S. Doyle.
There are election stories on four front pages. For the Irish Times and Irish Daily Mail, they're the lead story. The Times quotes senior sources in Fine Gael as acknowledging the findings of a number of published opinion polls that the party is struggling to make the case for re-election to many voters. But they say they will not alter their strategy to focus on the economy and Brexit. However, several senior sources said that the party would increase the volume and frequency of its warnings about returning control of the national finances and stewardship of the economy to Fianna Fáil. But, says the Times, Fianna Fáil and other opposition sources brushed off the Fine Gael warnings, pointing out that the message had failed to register sufficiently with voters in the early weeks of the campaign. The Examiner reports that Taoiseach Leo Varadkar is insisting that Fine Gael will fight to recover in the election campaign after another bruising poll for his party. He said it's half time, we're probably about 3 points down, but politics is hurling, not soccer, and we're going to pull this one back. Meanwhile, the Mail reports that concern is mounting in Fianna Fáil that Sinn Féin is now the biggest obstacle to the party ending its 8-year absence from government. This concern, the paper says, comes following analysis of a poll for the Mail on Sunday, which suggests an increase of 5 percentage points in support for Sinn Féin. Sinn Féin and Fianna Fáil are the subject of the Irish Independence story too. Philip Ryan reports that Sinn Féin has been accused of hypocrisy by Willie O'Dea of Fianna Fáil for voting to increase the state pension age in the north to 66 years, while pledging in the Republic to cut the age to 65. On the subject of pensions, the Independent in an editorial says that amid the noise of an election auction, we now seriously risk losing our way over the pensions issue. The writer recalls how in 2011, Fine Gael and Labour legislated to increase the pension age to 67 in 2021 and 68 in 2028. This was in line with the plan endorsed by the previous Fianna Fáil-led government, an example of forward planning to head off a pensions crisis. The pensions time bomb is no myth, says the Independent. The Irish Daily Star leads with the deaths of three children in their own home at Newcastle, County Dublin, an event described at Mass yesterday as unspeakable. The Irish Daily Mirror reports that Gardaí were questioning a woman last night after a man was stabbed to death at his family home in Gorey, County Wexford. Both stories are featured on the front page of the Irish Sun, which reports on two notes, which the paper says were found at the house in Newcastle. In the north, the Belfast Telegraph and Irish News both lead with a shooting in East Belfast at the weekend. The News says that the life of Belfast Republican Pat Fitzpatrick was spared by a jammed handgun. The paper notes that the victim was wearing a bulletproof vest. Bulletproof vest saved the life of top Republican, says the Telegraph headline. The paper says Fitzpatrick has told friends how he was inches from being killed by a masked assassin as he walks through the short strand on Saturday evening. The lead story for the Examiner is the news that a growing number of school children lack the basic skills to take part in sport and physical activity. As efforts to tackle childhood obesity continue, Jess Casey writes, new research from Dublin City University shows that one in four students between the ages of 5 and 12 cannot run properly, one in two cannot kick a ball, and one in five cannot throw a ball. The Mirror comments in an editorial, failing to take part in physical activity will have serious repercussions, not just for the children involved, but also the long-term health of the nation.
So, just past the halfway point in the election campaign, and the party leaders are preparing for the largest debate so far. Seven leaders will be in Galway for tonight's debate on Clare Byrne Live. Two weekend opinion polls continued the trend that had emerged in earlier surveys. The polls in the Business Post and the Mail on Sunday suggested that Fine Gael now trail Fianna Fáil. They also indicated a rise in support for Sinn Féin. Let's talk first this morning to our political correspondent, Micheál Lehane. Micheál, the trend in the polls has been fairly consistent, as have the issues highlighted by respondents. They're talking about health and they're talking about housing.
Yes, they are, and there is a very consistent pattern emerging there in that Ireland Thinks Mail on Sunday poll and the Business Post Red Sea poll as well. You see Fine Gael trailing Fianna Fáil, who are ahead by a margin of about 3 points, it seems, and then a solid green vote, and the big surge beyond the margin of error is going for Sinn Féin, up 9-19 in one poll and 20 in another poll. So that has set the tone, and it set the tone throughout the weekend, really. Some worries, I think, coming back from the field to Fianna Fáil, being asked questions particularly about that coalition question in relation to Sinn Féin, but of course both Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael yesterday answering that in categoric terms. So also the Taoiseach, and the Taoiseach reverting to hurling metaphors, it seems that hurling is going to become a part of all Irish elections. Ever since back in 2007, the late Seamus Brennan infused political parlance with hurling talk, the Taoiseach saying they're 3 points down Fine Gael at half-time, but they can pull it back. But there is no doubt that the particular strategy the party has adopted so far, and it seems that they are going to continue with it, focusing on economic recovery in the last few years and pointing back to Fianna Fáil's last time in government, that as of now doesn't appear to have resonated with voters. But I think if anything, that message is going to intensify. We saw on Saturday morning Pascal Dunne, who had a press conference where he picked holes repeatedly, as he saw it, in the Fianna Fáil manifesto. Micheál Martin countering fairly swiftly later on Saturday, saying that the Fine Gael manifesto was less prudent than the Fianna Fáil one, and indeed pointing, as he said, to promises that had been made in previous Fine Gael manifestos that weren't delivered on. He was particularly talking about the USC abolition in 2016. That setting the tone, that battle taking place between Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, but all the while support, according to the opinion polls, suggesting it is increasing for Sinn Féin.
As you say, Sinn Féin yet to publish its manifesto, but so far all the polls suggesting a rise in the party support.
Yes, and it seems the more criticism from Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael that's levelled in Sinn Féin's direction, and particularly those fairly strong comments yesterday, again, ruling out coalition, that in some ways is resonating with voters. And the people who talk about, and there's huge numbers detailed across polls as well, who say they want change, in largest numbers, those people appear to be, at this point, if you exclude the undecideds, seem to be zoning and moving towards Sinn Féin, and to a lesser extent to the Green Party, but the Green Party vote extremely solid there as well, somewhere between 8 and 10%, which would be above where it was in the local and European elections.
Can we talk, Micheál, about tonight's debate? Who will be there?
The seven party leaders in the Dáil will be there. So you have the People Before Profit leader, you've Sinn Féin, Fianna Fáil, obviously Labour, the Green Party, and the Social Democrats leader will be there. So this really allows all the party policies that have been published so far, it allows a debate to take place on them. We don't have all the manifestos yet, but we do have a lot of the policies out there. And it allows the smaller parties, which it seems inevitable, judging by opinion poll figures, will have a role in government formation, to set out their pitch clearest as well. And I suppose in some ways politics doesn't seem to change substantially over the last number of years. But then in other ways, you think back to this similar debate in 2016. And at that point, it was Stephen Donnelly, who was then at the Social Democrats, who seemed to be one of the leading figures, and Lucinda Creighton then at Renew. They were the people who dominated this big party political debate that time. Things have changed considerably in that period, but it is an opportunity, particularly for the smaller parties. And the smaller parties too, I mean, at one point in this election, there was a view that the Green Party and Labour were in some ways in contention for that possible role of Taoiseach afterwards. The research up to now in the first 2 weeks of the campaign would suggest the Greens have the edge on that one. So an opportunity for Labour, an opportunity too for the other smaller parties to assert themselves here.
Micheál, thanks indeed for joining us. Micheál Lehane there, our political correspondent.
And welcome to County Mayo. The biggest constituency voting in this year's general election on Saturday the 8th of February. We're in the TF Royal Hotel and Theatre in Castlebar, in the front window, looking out at the hospital on a very cold, dark morning, about a 5-minute walk from the centre of the town and a 3-hour drive from Dáil Éireann. This is the first time in 4 general elections in nearly 2 decades that Mayo won't get a chance to elect a prospective Taoiseach. But they can choose from a list that includes likely ministers, a former football hero and a firebrand environmentalist. Will the traditional split of seats between Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael persist? What issues will voters use to choose their TDs? We'll hear from a panel of guests later in the programme. But first, our reporter Fiacra O'Kioni is here and he's been examining the constituency and what's likely to happen when votes are counted on the 8th of February. Fiacra, tell us about the lie of the land in this 4-seat constituency.
Sure. Well, as you're saying, as a constituency, Mayo is traditionally split between Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil, with both parties viewing the area as safe ground despite long-standing health, jobs and transport problems in the area. This is underlined by the fact that of the 19 Mayo seats on offer in the 4 general elections since the turn of the century, 17 have been won by either party, in addition to Jean Poole, Fianna Fáil independent Beverly Cooper Flynn's win in 2007. That stranglehold included Fine Gael winning 4 seats to Fianna Fáil's 1 in the then 5-seat constituency in 2011, and it was repeated again in 2016 when Fine Gael's then leader and Taoiseach Enda Kenny and Minister Michael Ring both retained seats, as did Fianna Fáil's Dara Cleary and newcomer Lisa Chambers in the reduced 4-seat contest. It is expected that the two big beasts of Irish politics will fight it out again for Mayo spoils in this election, with predictions of a 50-50 split between the two parties. But it's important to note that Mayo is not immune to the changing landscape of Irish politics, with rumours in recent days of an upset potentially on the cards if either party does not maximise its votes.
Now, tell me about the key issues in this constituency.
Sure. Well, we've been travelling around the constituency in the past couple of days and been around Swinford, Foxford, Ballina and here on Castlebar over the last 24 hours. Among the issues that voters have been raising in that time with us are waiting lists and overcrowding in Mayo General, transport and road issues, a lack of jobs and fears over a 2-tier economy affecting Mayo. We'll return to the health issue later in the programme, but as we're about to hear, voters feel not enough is being done to bring jobs to the West.
Get roads and get jobs in, that's it, that's all we need.
Well, I think unemployment around here is very high, you know, and nobody seems to really care, I think, about us living down here. Well, everyone from around here actually is going to Dublin for employment, because there's very little employment down in the west of Ireland. And I know the jobs probably are in Dublin and not down here, but really the government should be doing something to kind of centralise jobs more out of Dublin and down to rural Ireland.
Jobs, basically, in rural Ireland has been ignored, and rural Ireland hasn't got fair play, basically.
We're not looking after people. Jobs are upgraded. We've companies that are millionaires and are giving nothing back to the people. People are working in factories for over 20 years and being made redundant. The people who own these factories are millionaires and closing it. But these people who give over 20 years, which is a life service, are getting paid just a basic redundancy package. Not one penny from the employer. I mean, again, where are we coming from? I think we've just lost it as a society. We forgot what we were about.
We're just coming out of the church in Swinford. Obviously, there's a general election in less than a fortnight's time. What issues do you think should be raised?
There's people getting up every morning and going to work and earning very little money, and they can't make it. But I feel bad for people that are worrying all the time about what they're going to do, how they're going to manage. It shouldn't be like this. You know, we live in a modern time, supposed to be, where the world has become a lot more prosperous, but yet there's still a lot of people struggling.
Very familiar themes there, Fiacra, and ones we'll talk about in more detail with our guests later in the programme. Now, tell me, who are the current TDs and who are their biggest rivals?
Sure. Well, the current TDs are, of course, ex-Taoiseach and Fine Gael leader Enda Kenny, who's based here in Castlebar, but he's not contesting this election. Minister for Rural Affairs, Michael Ring, who's based in Westport, Fianna Fáil's deputy leader, Dara Cleary, based in Ballina, and Fianna Fáil Brexit spokesperson, Lisa Chambers, who is also based here in Castlebar. Their main rivals in a 15-strong field are Fine Gael Senator and former TD Michelle Mulheron, based in Belmullet, Sinn Féin Senator Rose Conway-Walsh from Ballina, Fine Gael candidate and ex-Mayo GAA star Alan Dinnell from Castlebar, and Greens candidate Saoirse McHugh from Achill Island.
And what do you think is going to happen?
Well, due to geography, their record as TDs and the constituency's voting trends, Michael Ring and Dara Cleary are in strong positions to be re-elected. Similarly, Lisa Chambers is also likely to benefit from her high profile as Brexit spokesperson for Fianna Fáil. However, the final seat is likely to be hard fought, with four candidates eyeing up the opportunity. Among them is Fine Gael Senator Michelle Mulheron, who lost her seat in 2016 after some controversies while a TD, but is tipped by many to be in strong contention to benefit from Enda Kenny's departure. Fine Gael running mate Alan Dillon was considered a big name when he was selected by the party in 2018, and this is still the case. However, his decision not to run for last year's local elections and to instead focus on becoming a TD was not welcomed by all, and as such, he may find the national politics senior hurling is slightly more difficult than inter-county senior football. There's also no love lost between Miss Mulheron and Mr Dillon after they both had a very public falling out last week over where their election posters were placed in the constituency. Among the other candidates, Green Party's Saoirse McHugh is also running, and on a progressive platform similar to that of her MEP election campaign last year, but she may find that her base in Achill Island on the west coast and some criticism of green issues by farmers makes her election more of a challenge. Of the other main contenders, Sinn Féin Senator Rose Conway-Walsh appears to be the most likely to potentially spring a genuine surprise. Party sources say that while Mayo is traditionally a Fine Gael Fianna Fáil carve-up, they believe Sinn Féin's recent jump in poll support could offset last year's loss of a number of local councillors in the area and pushed their candidate into contention. Crucially, that claim has not been ruled out by rival parties.
Now, what should we watch out for?
Well, there's a number of issues we need to watch out for, some of which you referenced already. The odds do still indicate that a continuation of the traditional Fine Gael Fianna Fáil split is likely, but we need to watch out for a number of issues, including how Mayo voters respond to the first general election since 2002, where no would-be Taoiseach is running. The prospect of two local ministers if Fianna Fáil gains power, if Sinn Féin's poll rise will be reflected in Rose Conway-Walsh's performance, and if Saoirse McHugh can make inroads into the area.
Fiacra, thank you. That's our reporter, Fiacra O'Kioni. More from Castlebar in Mayo later in the programme. Let's get some business news now. Brian Finn is here.
Thanks, Gavin. Consumers and businesses have started the year off on an optimistic footing, according to Bank of Ireland's latest economic pulse. Employees are expecting pay increases, and many companies say they'll be awarding them. Sentiment was higher among both households and firms, with Brexit pessimism apparently dissipating. The UK is scheduled to leave the EU this Friday. The two sides are now looking to the next phase in the negotiations, the future relationship and trade arrangements. UK Brexit Secretary Stephen Barclay said yesterday that Britain was aiming for a zero tariff, zero quota free trade deal. In an interview with the BBC, Leo Varadkar said there wouldn't be a piecemeal deal. Boris Johnson has limited the next phase to just 11 months. Just as the US and EU were on course to strike a limited truce in their trade dispute this year, a new bone of contention has emerged. This time it's EU plans for a carbon tax. The US Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross said any attempts to slap an environmental levy on US firms would be met with punitive measures against Brussels. Currencies finally, the euro is trading at $1.103 and 84.4 pence sterling.
Well, speaking of senior hurling, an extra 10 minutes is to be added to GAA training sessions to focus on mental health. As first reported by the Irish News, what's known as the huddle will encourage players to talk about any problems they're having and to look out for each other. Colin Regan is the GAA's community and health manager. He joins us on the line. Colin, thanks for talking to us this morning. Where did this idea come from and what will it involve?
Well, we have last year marked our fifth year anniversary in partnership with Samaritans as the GAA's official mental health partner. And over that time, it became clear that initially there were, people might think that Samaritans is exclusively around suicide prevention, and that is one of their main aims, but they also work further upstream in terms of, for example, their helpline. It's the issues that we all deal with in life and everyday challenges that make up the bulk of those calls. So we have been working with the National Office for Suicide Prevention and the Public Health Agency across the 32 counties to deliver training called Safe Talk. And that is very much suicide prevention and intervention. However, we identified that there was a need to do something more upstream, so to speak, around just emotional literacy. At the top of the hour in your news report, it noted the lack of physical literacy in young people at the moment. And we also know that people engaging with Gaelic games or other organised sport tend to have better physical literacy. So we just want to now focus on also developing their emotional literacy.
So how will this work? What will it involve?
Well, basically, the kernel of the idea came from a Samaritans volunteer, Magella Canty, who is also a coach in our local club, Cove, which participates in our Healthy Club project. And Magella recognised, and we would have seen, that trying to get players, young males in particular, into an organised or coordinated workshop around mental health is very challenging. They're very busy with their playing schedules, training schedules, etc. So instead, Magella said, well, we're on the field with them already. Why not take the message to them in that space? So Magella trialled a number of deliveries, what she called the huddle. So it's just replicating that very familiar huddle that we see before a match or after a match, and bringing it onto the training pitch or even into the changing room. And it just legitimizes the conversation around emotional literacy, gets the recipients to acknowledge that in this day and age, their emotional literacy is as much a part of their sporting life and their everyday life as their physical literacy, something they're very familiar with in a sporting context. And then it does also signpost them to some of the services in their own locale that might be useful to them should they need a little bit of additional help. For example, Samaritans free phone helpline 116 123. We're just at a very much at the test pilot with this here. We have 150 clubs starting into our new Healthy Club project phase 4 this coming Saturday. They'll be in Croke Park for a National Orientation Day, and we'll be highlighting that the huddle is going to be piloted amongst that cohort across 2020 to see what demand is like and maybe to tweak the content as well.
All right. Well, listen, thank you very much indeed for talking to us this morning, and we look forward to hearing more about this over the coming months. That was Colin Regan. He's the GAA's Community and Health Manager. The time is 7:30.
We start with this very tragic news from the US overnight, the death of basketball legend Kobe Bryant, one of 9 people killed in that helicopter crash in California. Just 41 years of age, travelling in a private helicopter. It came down. His daughter also on board. She just 13 years of age. Bryant, of course, I think one of those names that just transcends sport, really. 5-time NBA champion. Played for the LA Lakers, of course, throughout his career. And I think he was the face of basketball, the NBA in America for 2 decades. And if you just look at the reaction on social media, both last night and this morning, it's world leaders, it's biggest names in sport, music, entertainment. I think he's this type of guy, and it's one of a few that no matter where you are in the world, the average person on the street will have heard of Kobe Bryant, wouldn't they?
Yeah, that's true to say. They even paid a tribute to him, I think, at the Grammys, which were on last night. Amazing reaction, like really, really overwhelming.
Yeah, it is. So we're going to have a lot more on this story coming up after the sport right now, and I'll have more in an hour's time as well here on Morning Ireland. Basketball news at home. Kilester, massive win for them last night in the Hula Hoops Women's National Cup final, beating Brunel 82 points to 59. Now, Kilester, one of the long established clubs in this country, but before last night, they'd only won the Women's Cup once before, and that was 18 years ago. Rebecca Nagel was MVP. She top scored with 23 points, and she's been chatting Greg Allen about what this win means.
We've honestly waited for this for so long. we've worked so hard. I think, like, we were here in 2016, and that's all, that has been in the back of our heads. You know, we worked hard. It was a complete team effort. I'm just so proud of the girls, and yeah, we'll definitely celebrate this one.
You've got a great history in national leagues, you know, going back to the very beginning of the National League 40 years ago, but only winning your second cup, it must be huge for the club.
Absolutely huge. You know, every single person in this club backed us, and, you know, they're there week in, week out. We've so many supporters, we've, you know, so many volunteers in the committee, and it's like a big family, and it's actually emotional, and I feel like I'm going to cry. But yeah, it's such a big thing for the club, and it's personally my first ever Super League National Cup win, so I'll definitely be celebrating this with the club now for the next few weeks, I'd say. Yeah,
well, enjoy the celebrations, Rebecca. Well done to you and all your teammates. Mark Leishman won the Farmers Insurance Open in the US. He finished on 15 under par. Rory McIlroy just came up in his short, winning that title, finished in a tie for third and 12 under, so just three shots back. Had a bit of a roller coaster ride, bogeyed three of the first four holes, but then went on to record six birdies and an eagle. If he had won last night, he would have gone to world number one in the rankings. Stephanie Meadow finished in 35th place in the Gainbridge LPGA event in Florida. Waterford, Galway, Clare and Kilkenny were winners in Division 1 of the Allianz Hurling League. Elsewhere, wins for Offaly, Antrim, Kildare, Derry, Tyrone, Longford and Armagh, and Fermanagh. Some new faces on the sidelines this year. Brian Lone, one of those, no stranger to Clare Hurling, of course, a legend in those parts, two-time All-Ireland winner, but he was happy and relieved, I think, to get his first win under the belt as Clare manager. They beat Carlow yesterday, and Brian's been speaking to Martin Kiley.
Great to get the first game at home in the league. It's important to win it, and as we did, we won it, so we're happy enough for that.
What's the most impressive part from your point of view, Brian? You know, you're just into the fold, but good lot of movement, good lot of balance in the team, and a lot of very good scores.
Yeah, well, I suppose, look, since we've got involved, say, and started training 9-10 weeks ago, the work rate and the attitude of the players has been exceptional. Really, yeah, yeah. Really, really good. That's probably the most I suppose important and impressive aspect of the display is the work rate, not just here now, but on the training field as well. So we'll be hoping to continue that.
And overall, Brian, are you happy the way things have gone for you since you came into the job?
Happy so far, but you know, I suppose it's a game of results, like, so it's grand when you win, but when you lose it's a different story. So yeah, happy enough so far.
Yeah, I'm sure he is. We'll keep the Clare contingent in the studio happy this morning.
Keeping it, not just Clare, keeping it Shannon.
Oh yeah,
this
exactly. In football, Tyrone beat Mead in Division 1. Galway overcame Monaghan. Roscommon and Laois drew in Division 2. Wins also for Westmeath and Kildare in Division 3. Longford beat Louth. Tipperary drew with Down, and in Division 4, victories for Antrim and Sligo. In the Little National Football League, wins for Waterford and Mayo. Dublin and Tip drew. Schlochneil will meet Sarsfields in the AIB All-Ireland Club Camogie final. That final will be live on Sunday Sport early next month. Manchester City and Manchester United progressed to the fifth round of the FA Cup. Shrewsbury, though, held Liverpool to a 2-2 draw. Jurgen Klopp not happy at the final whistle.
We had today so many invitations, sent so many invitations to the opponent that it's difficult then to win a game. So I don't think that we have enough time to tell all the things which were not right today. Though difficult to explain immediately after the game, but yeah, well deserved. Congratulations to Shrewsbury. That was the minimum what they deserved today.
And finally, on the tennis front, Simona Halep, Garbiñe Muguruza and Dominic Thiem among those to qualify for the quarterfinals at the Australian Open this morning. Gavin, we'll go back to you in Castlebar.
American basketball superstar Kobe Bryant and his daughter Gianna are among nine people who died in a helicopter crash in Southern California. A five-time NBA champion and two-time Olympic gold medalist, he's considered one of the greatest players in the game's history and one of the best-known sports stars in the US. Here's Los Angeles County Sheriff Alex Villanova talking about what happened to the nine people on the helicopter.
We're waiting the arrival of the coroner's office to assist in the recovery of the remains. As the chief indicated, there were no survivors. We have a manifest that indicates that there was nine people on board the aircraft, the pilot plus eight individuals. And we're assisting the families of those who believe they've been impacted, and it's a tough process. And our hope goes out to all of the members that were on board, all the family of everyone who was on board this aircraft, and God bless their souls.
Gianna Bryant hoped to follow in her father's footsteps and become a professional basketball player. She shared her father's love of the game, and they were on their way to take part in a tournament for younger players when the crash happened. Here's Kobe talking about Gianna on The Tonight Show with Jimmy Fallon.
Do you think your daughter might want to play in the WNBA?
She does, for sure.
She does?
I mean, this kid, man.
She's Wouldn't like, that be great?
Dude, man, I'm telling you. The best thing that happens is when we go out and fans will come up to me and she'll be standing next to me and they'll be like, hey, you got to have a boy. You and V got to have a boy, man. You got somebody carry on the tradition, the legacy. She's like, oi, I got this. You know, boy for that, I got you. Like, that's right. Yes, you do. You got this.
Kobe Bryant talking about his daughter Gianna. Pat Burke is a former professional basketball player originally from Tullamore in County Offaly. He's the only Irish-born man to ever play in the NBA and was Kobe Bryant's opponent on several occasions. He spoke to our reporter Tommy Mescal and began by sharing his memories of Kobe.
I did play against him, and you know, when you, it's like anything, when you're going up against an opponent that has got, you know, so much notoriety and attention, it's, you know, when you first see them in real life, there's a little bit of an awestruck feeling, but having competed against him and just to see how driven he is, I don't know if you can put it into words.
Do you think that's why he transcended basketball? He was known not just as a fantastic basketball player, but he is being admired and remembered today by people from every sport. He was, I suppose, the ultimate sportsman for many people.
I think that's definitely a part of it. I think that what has him transcending the sport is also how, not just the way he carried himself on the court, but his story before, like, you know, here's a young boy who grew up in admiration of his father, who played professional basketball. And he spent some time in Italy. He picked up a second language. He plays high school basketball here in the United States, and he's drafted in the first round right out of high school. And so there's so much to relate to, and there's so much that I think a lot of people would dream to have accomplished with him.
That was Pat Burke. He's a former professional basketball player speaking to Tommy Mescal. Let's talk to Jeff Shepherd. He's a U.S. sports reporter based in New Orleans. Jeff, good morning. Thanks for taking our call.
I appreciate it. Thank you for having me.
The death of a superstar. Tell us about how big Kobe Bryant was.
So as Pat said, I mean, it really did transcend basketball. This was simply stunning. I mean, the only thing that could have been more, I guess, you know, stunning, for lack of a better word, would be as if this would have happened while he was still playing basketball. He had successfully made the transition from an NBA superstar. And when you are an NBA superstar, you are a global icon. I mean, you know, this is the guy who took the torch from Michael Jordan and then handed it off to LeBron James. He played 20 seasons all in Los Angeles, you know, the second largest city in America, the second largest television market. He won 5 championships. He had some iconic moments. He had some iconic teammates. It is an absolute stunning loss. And it feels like, you know, Kobe came in contact with basically everything in the sports world, the pop culture world, the music world, even sometimes into the world of politics over the last 2 decades. And so it's not that he was just trying to hog the spotlight. It's just he was always there, and it was somebody that you could always count on seeing in the purple and gold of the Lakers. And to have him, you know, pass away in such a tragic manner, it really is just a shocking, stunning loss.
Unlike Michael Jordan, he was prepared to walk away from basketball, and he had a life. He looked like he had a life outside basketball ready for him.
Absolutely. And again, I mean, he had six, you know, so many. Father Time is undefeated against all of these players, you know, men, women, all these athletes that are professionals that want to play until they're 45 and 50 years old. They eventually all can no longer compete at that level. And Kobe stepped away after battling injuries and, some down times in Los Angeles. And he had moved on into the next chapter of his life. You mentioned he was with his daughter. They were on their way to play in a basketball game with another player on their team was apparently also involved as well. He was coaching her. He was working with her. He was traveling all over the world just being a basketball fan and being a fan of sport in general. But he also had other interests outside of athletics. He was a producer of a animated short film that won an Oscar in 2018. He was hosting a show on ESPN, which is the largest American sports programming network. And he wasn't just doing like a studio show and doing a job as a presenter there. He wanted it in his own likeness. He wanted to do it in his own way. And so he would break down specific parts of basketball or specific players' games. And that was how he wanted to do it. So he was absolutely transitioned into the next phase of his career. He didn't go into retirement kicking and screaming like you see so many other athletes do.
Yes, that film, Dear Basketball, it's a very short film. It's available widely online, and it's beautiful. Briefly, Jeff, amongst the people, other people who were killed on the plane, his daughter Gianna, as we mentioned, who was set for a role as a superstar in her own career. She was a super basketball player.
Well, as you heard in that clip, you know, when he was on the late night talk show, he had successfully also passed on his competitive gene to his daughter Gianna, and she had taken it up. She was likely going to play college basketball, and if she would have been successful, maybe could have played in the WNBA or played internationally or both, as you see a lot of stars do. Yes, there are a lot of people. Obviously, it's hard to relate to being an NBA basketball superstar, but it's not hard to relate to being a parent and taking your kid to a basketball game and for all of this to happen the way it went down. That's the thing I think that also really hits home for a lot of people.
Jeff, thanks for talking to us. That's Jeff Shepherd, a U.S. sports reporter based in New Orleans.
Brian Finn is back with the business.
Thanks, Rachel. Consumers and businesses have started 2020 on a note of considerable optimism. The latest Bank of Ireland economic pulse for the month of January has recorded an uplift in sentiment among households and firms. Loretta O'Sullivan, chief economist with Bank of Ireland, is here. And the uplift, Loretta, is being attributed to some clarity around Brexit. And it's amazing how quickly it's dissipated as a potential threat, given that it hasn't gone away as such. Is there some wishful thinking going on?
Morning, Brian. Certainly, okay, so no January blues for consumers or businesses, and it is related to the Brexit piece, as you say. The UK set to leave the EU on Friday, but the worst case outcome of a no deal Brexit has been avoided. We know that there's going to be a transition period now till the end of 2020. And it looks like that this has provided some sort of breathing space for households and firms. And both of them started the new year on a more positive note.
So the fog is lifting.
Absolutely. Yeah, it has lifted a little bit, and that's provided some relief. And we've seen this month households more confident about the economy and their own finances. That helped a little bit about some good news on the pay side, and households and firms also more positive across all the different sectors.
And on the question of pay, some workers are expecting pay increases. Some employers say they're going to be giving them. So how much can they expect?
Absolutely. They're pretty much aligned. The survey findings show that 43% of firms are expecting to increase pay this year, and about 47% of workers are expecting to get a pay rise. Very much reflecting the fact that the economy is effectively at full employment. We have labour shortages in some sectors. We have a situation where workers are finding it fairly easy to move or to change jobs. And as a result of that, it's translating into some pressure on wages.
And the average increase expected is around 3.6%. That will sound very generous to some people who may not be expecting any pay increases. So is this being driven by particular sectors, perhaps?
It's in and around. That's the average of what firms are expecting to give. A little bit higher on the industry on the services side. So in there, you'd have some of the tech firms, ICT and so on. But if we look at the CSO data, it is coming in and around that mark now for the last period of time. Wages have been ticking up, reflecting that piece around the tighter labour market. We're also going to see an increase in the minimum wage coming through as well in a couple of weeks.
You also ask people about their expectations around the housing market, and this housing part of the index was down in January. What's that being attributed to?
It's around house price expectations. So they had risen a touch at the end of last year as some of that Brexit uncertainty dissipated. This month, some cooling in expectations again. Saying that, that, 44% of households still think that house prices are going to increase in the next year, and around 1 in 10 are saying that they plan to buy or build a property. I will say that we did this survey, this month's survey, before a lot of the political parties were out, before the election campaign got underway, so before we got a sense of where their housing policies were going to go. So it may be the case that as they come to fruition and they start to go into talks around forming a partnership for government and so on, that we'll see over the coming months what impact those policies have on housing demand and price expectations.
And could talks over the formation of a government impact on the market, given that people will hold off to see what the final outcome of talks will be?
It will depend where it goes. So there has obviously been some speculation around a Help to Buy scheme, some changes there. So it may be the case that while people are waiting to see what happens with that, that they step back a little bit. The construction sector as a whole tends to be quite sensitive to uncertainty. So even though the Brexit uncertainty may have lifted and some of the fog has gone there, it is a sector that can be impacted by what happened, homegrown uncertainty.
Loretta O'Sullivan, Chief Economist with Bank of Ireland, thank you very much. Indeed, more business news at 8:30. Now it's back to Gavin in Mayo.
Joanna Donnelly is at Metairn. Morning, Joanna.
Very good morning. Yeah, it's really cold across the west and in the northwest in particular. Those showers are coming in, streaming in off the Atlantic, and they're giving rumbles of thunder all along coastal areas. There's sleet and some hail and some snow all mixed in. There'll be accumulations of snow mostly over the hills and mountains, but the snow will fall down to lower levels at times too. It gives pretty pictures, but hopefully it will be moving on fairly quickly. Today, highest temperatures 3 to 6 degrees and the winds moderate to fresh and gusty southwest, easing up moderate later. In the south and in the east of the country, there'll be better breaks and better spells of sunshine, but through the afternoon, you're going to see some frequent showers there too. Then tonight, the showers will be a little bit more isolated, confined back to the west and north, once again with long clear spells and temperatures down to minus 1 degree in the air. So a nice sharp frost in the ground there overnight tonight. And again, the winds will be moderate, occasionally fresh southwesterly. It'll be a breezy day tomorrow and still cold too, 4 to 6 degrees tomorrow, but the winds are going to get a little bit stronger, fresh to strong southwest winds, so it'll feel a bit cooler and there'll be more showers, and some of them, once again, it'll be wintry. Overnight, Tuesday night, temperatures not quite as low, but still down to freezing in places. On Wednesday, the temperature's going to rise up a little bit, about 7 to 9 degrees on Wednesday. Maybe a bit of rain across the northern parts on Wednesday. On Thursday, we'll have rain moving up from the south, clearing to showers. It'll be a dry for the afternoon and temperatures a little higher then again on Thursday. And Friday at the weekend, currently looking like it'll remain unsettled with rain at times and breezy for a time too to start the weekend. In the meantime today, heavy showers, wintry conditions there, particularly across the west and northwest. So do take care if you're out and about in traffic. That's it. Good morning.
A very good morning to you. It's 8:00 on Monday, the 27th of January. This is Morning Ireland with Gavin Jennings in Castlebar and Rachel English in Dublin. With the news now, here's Brian Jennings.
The Director General of the World Health Organization is due in Beijing today to discuss how the coronavirus infection can be contained. The number of confirmed deaths from the virus in China has risen to 81, with more than 2,700 people infected. While all of the deaths so far are from the province of Hubei, half of those infected are from outside. The Chinese Prime Minister Li Keqiang has visited the city of Wuhan, where the first case was reported. The Lunar New Year holiday has been extended by 3 days in a bid to encourage people to stay at home. Officials have established that people can pass on the infection before they show any symptoms, making it much harder to contain. President Higgins is among the world heads of state in Poland today to mark the 75th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz-Birkenau. About 200 survivors will also attend the commemoration, which begins with a wreath-laying ceremony this morning. Today is International Holocaust Remembrance Day, in memory of the millions of men, women and children who lost their lives in Nazi death camps during the Second World War. As the election campaign passes the halfway mark, political parties and independent candidates will continue campaigning across the country today. Tonight, 7 party leaders will take part in the RT televised debate in NUI Galway. Our political correspondent, Micheál Lehan.
This is the period that could yet define election 2020. The campaign is now set to intensify with just 12 full days of canvassing left. Tonight's debate in Galway takes on added significance, especially given that four opinion polls have all now suggested that Fine Gael trail Fianna Fáil, and it indicates an increase in support for Sinn Féin and a solid Green Party vote. The Fine Gael leader Leo Varadkar conceded at the weekend that in hurling terms his party is 3 points behind at half-time, but he insisted it can be turned around. Today the parties will publish more policies. Fianna Fáil will outline proposals to tackle high insurance costs. Fine Gael will detail education policies, while the Green Party will focus on the area of water quality.
The Taoiseach Leo Varadkar will meet the European Commission's chief Brexit negotiator Michel Barnier at government buildings this morning. The meeting takes place just days before the UK formally leaves the EU on Friday. Among the issues to be discussed will be the next phase of negotiations, including a trade deal. The funeral mass of Seamus Mallon, the former STLP deputy leader and former Northern Ireland deputy first minister, will take place in County Armagh at noon today. Mr. Mallon died on Friday, aged 83. Our Northern editor Tommy Gorman.
In keeping with his request, Seamus Mallon's funeral mass will take place in St. James Catholic Church, Mullabrack. 3 years ago, the Requiem Mass for his wife Gertrude was also held in what is their local place of worship. He was glad that he lived to see a five-party power-sharing administration take office in Stormont earlier this month. Led by First Minister and DUP leader Arlene Foster and Deputy First Minister Sinn Féin's Michelle O'Neill, all five parties will be represented today. The Taoiseach Leo Varadkar, Taoiseach Simon Coveney, Fianna Fáil leader Micheál Martin and leading party members will attend. The Northern Ireland Secretary Julian Smith will represent the British government. The chief celebrant will be the Catholic Archbishop of Armagh, Eamon Martin. The Mass will be concelebrated by the local parish priest, Father Michael Woods. As requested by Seamus Mallon, the retired Department of Foreign Affairs diplomat, Tim O'Connor, will give the reflection. RTE's News Now service will provide live coverage of the funeral from midday.
Tributes have been paid to the retired US basketball star Kobe Bryant, who died in a helicopter crash in California yesterday. Officials say eight other people, including Mr. Bryant's 13-year-old daughter Gianna, were killed when the helicopter crashed on a hillside about 65 kilometres northwest of Los Angeles. The 41-year-old five-time NBA champion with the LA Lakers was widely considered one of the greatest players in the sport's history. Now the time is coming up to 5:30 past 8.
RTE Radio 1 weather with ESB Networks. Stay safe, stay clear when working near overhead electricity wires. For emergencies, call 1850 372 999.
Scattered wintry showers, most frequent in the west, with sunshine in between. Highest temperatures 3 to 6 degrees, with moderate to fresh and gusty southwest winds and a risk of thunder.
In the Mayo News and the Western People, there are plenty of pictures from the campaign trail, talk of turf wars, and a column from Adrian Langan entitled "Within Every Mayo Voter is a Little Healy Ray," with a look at what it says in the daily papers this morning. Here's John S. Doyle.
For the Irish Times and Irish Daily Mail, the election is the lead story. The Times quotes senior sources in Fine Gael as acknowledging the findings of a number of published opinion polls that the party is struggling to make the case for re-election to many voters. But they say they will not alter their strategy to focus on the economy and Brexit. However, several senior sources said that the party would increase the volume and frequency of its warnings about returning control of the national finances and stewardship of the economy to Fianna Fáil, attack them bald-headed, in the words of one source. But, says the Times, Fianna Fáil and other opposition sources brushed off the Fine Gael warnings, pointing out that the message had failed to register sufficiently with voters in the early weeks of the campaign. The Irish Examiner reports the Taoiseach Leo Varadkar as insisting that Fine Gael will fight to recover in the election campaign after another bruising poll for his party. He said it's half-time, we're probably about 3 points down, but politics is hurling, not soccer, and we're going to pull this one back. Meanwhile, the Mail reports that concern is mounting in Fianna Fáil, that Sinn Féin is now the biggest obstacle to the party, ending its 8-year absence from government. This concern, the paper says, comes following analysis of a poll for the Mail on Sunday, which suggests an increase of 5 percentage points in support for Sinn Féin. Sinn Féin and Fianna Fáil are the subject of the Irish Independence story too. Philip Ryan reports that Sinn Féin has been accused of hypocrisy by Willie O'Dea of Fianna Fáil for voting to increase the state pension age in the north to 66 years while pledging in the Republic to cut the age to 65. On the subject of pensions, The Independent in an editorial says that amid the noise of an election auction, we now seriously risk losing our way over the pensions issue. The writer recalls how in 2011, Fine Gael and Labour legislated to increase the pension age to 67 in 2021 and 68 in 2028. This was in line with the plan endorsed by the previous Fianna Fáil-led government, an example of forward planning to head off a pensions crisis. The pensions time bomb is no myth, says The Independent. The Irish Daily Star leads with the deaths of three children in their own home at Newcastle, County Dublin, an event described at Mass yesterday as unspeakable. The Irish Daily Mirror reports that Gardaí were questioning a woman last night after a man was stabbed to death at his family home in Gorey, County Wexford. Both stories are featured on the front page of the Irish Sun, which reports on two notes which the paper says were found at the house in Newcastle. In the north, the Belfast Telegraph and Irish News both lead with a shooting in East Belfast at the weekend. The News says that the life of Belfast Republican Pat Fitzpatrick was spared by a jammed handgun. By contrast, the Telegraph headline says, "Bulletproof vest saved the life of top Republican." The paper says Fitzpatrick told friends how he was inches from being killed by a masked assassin as he walked through the short strand on Saturday evening. The lead story for the Examiner is the news that a growing number of school children lack the basic skills to take part in sport and physical activity. As Jess Casey writes, new research from Dublin City University shows that 1 in 4 students between the ages of 5 and 12 cannot run properly, 1 in 2 cannot kick a ball, and 1 in 5 cannot throw a ball. None of those could be said of the late Seamus Mallon, who as a young man played Gaelic football for Armagh and who died on Friday at the age of 83. The Times carries an appreciation by his SDLP colleague Hugh Logue, who was elected to the Northern Ireland Assembly with Mallon in 1973. Logue recalls that Mallon had a penchant for using GAA football terminology, ahead of the showdown meetings on decommissioning or policing, going to other meetings he would say, "Remember, this is only a club match." Asked what he meant, he explained that too many good players missed out on All-Ireland finals due to an injury in a club game.
Support services, including counselling, are being made available to schools and local groups in the Newcastle area of County Dublin following the tragic deaths of three children. Yesterday, prayers were said for siblings Conor McGinley, aged 9, Dara, aged 7, and Carla, who was 3. They were found dead at their home on Friday. Their mother remains in hospital. Yesterday, prayers were said in Newcastle for the McGinley family. Father Kevin Doherty, who's the co-parish priest at St Finian's Church, addressed a packed congregation at Sunday morning Mass. And afterwards, he spoke to our reporter, Laura Hogan.
I think the whole thing about it is we really can't put words on it. The darkness is so dark and it's unspeakable. Grief, heartbreak, loss, and you know, it affects and touches everybody in this community. And I saw all the parents there. We had a communion preparation mass today, and the parents coming, and you could see the grief in their heart as well. And maybe they held their children a little bit closer today, you know. And so it's out of the darkness that somehow we have to find the light, and you know, in the kindness of people, there is light. In the brokenness of people, that there is light, just to show that this is what it does to us. And all we do is we gather and we pray and we ask for peace and light. And the children today, in their own way, spoke that light, and it's that was good for us. Do you know?
Can you explain to us just how you tried to help the children to understand what they may be feeling today?
Yeah, What we did was we just used a little jigsaw, of a two-piece jigsaw of a broken, of a heart that could be fixed or broken. And we just did a little thing with them and asked them where their heart was. Was it happy? Was it sad? And then they had to make a decision as to where the heart should be. How close it should be to really happy, or is it really, really sad? And they took a vote on it and decided this is where our heart is today. And then we did a little thing with a candle, lit the candle, and I hope that was something for them and for their parents as well.
Father Kevin Doherty speaking to Laura Hogan. Well, as we heard there, children, and not just those who knew the McGinleys, are likely to have questions about what happened, and it is hard to know what to say. Suzanne Connolly, CEO of the children's charity Barnardo's, is with us. Can we talk first of all, Suzanne, about the children who did know Connor or Dara or Carla? This is going to be very strange for them, and they are likely to have questions, and they're likely to be talking among themselves. What should parents or teachers say to those questions?
Well, I'd like to start off by saying that, like all adults and parents and young people and children listening to Morning Ireland today, our hearts go out to the family and friends of Connor, Dara and Carla, who died so tragically on Friday. So we all feel shock, we feel disbelief, we feel horror and a deep sadness. And it's important as well that we recognise that we don't understand why this happened, and that people get a chance to talk to each other and talk about their feelings. And I would think that what parents need to do is not to speculate with their children, but to offer their children reassurance that most children in Ireland are very, very safe in their own homes.
That's a good point, because you can imagine this morning that there will be children who aren't familiar with seeing pictures of children on the news, and they'll have seen the pictures of those three who look just like them, and they'll be wondering, am I safe? Can something bad happen to me?
And that's why it's very important those children get reassurance from their parents and from their teachers. And any parents or teachers who are unsure, Barnardo's, we do have a bereavement line open this morning, able to offer advice, support and information. And again, I can't stress too strongly for children to know that they are mostly very, very safe. And it's okay to feel sad and to feel unsure and to feel scared and to get that extra hug.
There's a lot we genuinely don't know and a lot of speculation. So when a child asks what happened, mummy or daddy, or asks their teacher that question, what's the best way to respond?
The best way to respond is to say that we don't know. If they ask more specific questions, to say this is what some people are saying, but there's still a lot more to find out.
And again, you wanted to emphasise the fact that, you know, there's no need for children to be in any way scared or concerned themselves, because maybe some of them will be this morning.
Some children may well be scared and concerned, and I think it's very important to reassure them that they are safe, that they're loved, that they're cared for. And what's happened, this awful thing that's happened, is very, very rare. But again, we would say if any parent out there or any teacher is wondering what to say, they can contact Barnardo's Bereavement Helpline. And we do offer specific services in schools as well, because what we really do encourage is that adults who know the children, like teachers, get some support to know what to say.
What supports are likely to be available in the school, Scolcronon, where the two boys went, Scolcronon in Rathcoole today? And what supports are children likely to need?
Well, what will happen is that I know Tusla have been contacted, and the Educational Psychology Service will be out there, and they may well ask that Barnardo's goes out and offers some support, which we will do. Children will be given an opportunity to express how they feel in writing, through pictures. Teachers will be given a chance to talk about how they feel, and everybody will be there together and to share some love and care and to be very sad together.
Suzanne, thank you so much for joining us this morning. That was Suzanne Connolly, who's CEO of Barnardo's.
Yes, welcome back to the biggest constituency in the country, with less than 2 weeks to go to the general election on the day of a seven-leader TV debate and at the start of the week that Britain leaves the EU. The sun is up over County Mayo, but it's struggling to move the sheet of sleet from the cars and rooftops around us here across the road from the hospital in Castlebar in the centre of the county. There's no Taoiseach to vote for this time here, for the first time since 2002. Some candidates are likely to be senior ministers, and the issues that face them and voters here are very familiar to elections of the past. Jobs, roads, health, concerns that people are leaving, concerns for the people left behind. And as our reporter Fiacra O'Kioni has been finding out, voters in Mayo want solutions too on the environment, broadband, pensions and schools.
I think it would be good if we had an improvement on the infrastructure for the roads living in County Mayo. I think particularly for business it would be great if we could have an improvement on the roads. It's fine almost halfway down the country, but then the last leg of the journey to Mayo we could definitely do with some more improvement and development.
As a student, I think that the public transport needs to be improved to help us get around to our colleges, and also a big issue is the environment. So I'm very interested in the environment, and that impacts us as young people a lot, so that needs to be looked at as well.
We don't have great broadband around here, so that would be an issue for us.
Okay. And how would it affect you? These are your two kids here as well. Is it in terms of family stuff or is it in terms of business stuff? Or
well, both.
It?
Yeah, we could maybe work from home if we had decent broadband. But and entertainment wise as well, but definitely it would help if we could work from home. Anywhere outside Dublin, it's probably, we all have the same issues, I think.
Housing and pensions would be the main. The homeless and pensions, that increasing the age basically to 67, and a lot of people thought they would get the pension at 65 originally. Well, they're listening now, but they weren't listening. They weren't listening until now, basically, when there's votes involved, and they need to take heed of, because it will affect the election. People will vote accordingly.
The schools need more funding as well for education and books and reading program. Emma goes to a country school, and
This is your son.
This is my son, Emmett. Yes. He's 9 and he goes to a country school, and we had to fundraise to raise 10,000 for a reading programme. And while that's good and well, there still isn't enough money for the school. And I'm sure that's not just Emmett's school, it's every school.
That's voters talking to Fiacra O'Kioni yesterday. A reminder that not only can you listen to Morning Ireland, you can also watch us too on RTE News Now on your phone, your tablet, or on your TV on Sairview. And with me in the front window of the TF Royal Hotel in Castlebar this morning, Tom McHale is a local businessman. He's owner of McHale Agri. Liamy McNally is a local documentary maker. Martin Flatley is chairman of the Castlebar Men's Shed. And Teresa O'Malley is news editor at Midwest Radio. Thank you all very much for braving the cold this morning to come in to talk to us. Tom, I'll come to you first of all. You set up that business in 2008, a very difficult time to set up any business, particularly in the west of Ireland. How are you doing now?
We're doing okay, Gavin, but we're having to work very hard at it. At the end of the day, the business that we're involved in, consumers and rural dwellers need our products and services, so they're not a luxury item or anything like that. But we've worked very hard over 12 years to stay in business and to keep the bills paid.
And are farmers spending money?
We're hearing plenty of farmers' woes in store, the Brexit issue, the uncertainty around that. Obviously, the beef plan there was a problem there. So I don't think it's still resolved either as well. So the farming spend, they're probably a lot more careful with the checkbooks at the moment.
You've young children. Do you think that they'll stay in Mayo?
I wouldn't ask my children to stay in Mayo. I'd ask them to follow their dreams wherever that takes them, whether it's Dublin, New York, or back here in Mayo. But we would like, I think there's a lot of regional imbalance, and we would like more opportunities, more jobs in Mayo, so that somebody can consider Mayo as a future, somewhere to live, a good life.
Martin Flatley, tell me about the men who come to the men's shed here in Castlebar.
Okay, and indeed, maybe a little bit of a background. The men at the moment, the men's shed is in operation for the last 10 years in Ireland. There are about 450 sheds scattered across the country, and there are almost 10,000 people involved, 10,000 men. The men who might come are older, retired, isolated, underemployed, or vulnerable either mentally or physically.
And what are the issues that are concerning them ahead of this election?
Okay, they continually affect us, whether there's an election or not.
Yes.
Again, the main issue is, and focus on them, is a lack of a clear line of capital funding. the men's sheds are on a voluntary basis. So if there's a shed open in the morning, it's done with local help on a voluntary basis. There is no central capital funding. The second point is there's a lack of support in terms of administration and management, where there's 45 men in the shed in Castlebar. And we have to do the admin, accountability, transparency on a total voluntary basis. The third point is the big one, insurance. Insurance is a big obstacle. And an example was where we had a whip around this last couple of weeks to support one of the local men's sheds in a smaller area to help them pay the insurance. 3-4 years ago, the insurance for our shed in Castlebar was €400 or €500. This year, it'll be between 1,000 and 1,200.
Gosh, that's doubled.
This is a big, big obstacle to actually maintaining a service that's filling a serious gap in men's lives in terms of health and well-being.
Have you replaced rural pubs to some extent as a natural place for older men to gather and to talk?
That's an interesting point, and it raises the question why about 10,000 people have joined the men's shed movement. Old, isolated, there is no place for people to meet. In rural Ireland, where I spent most of my life and where I came from, the pub is on the point of closing. The local multi-purpose shop is closing. The post office is closed. The bank is online. So the people who living, particularly in the western seaboard, on small holdings of land, they don't have access to broadband, won't sort their problem. When somebody picks up a phone and rings the bank or the post office, and you get 25 options, and the older person wants to talk, wants help, what button do they serve? 20 buttons later, they still haven't found what they wanted.
Liam McHale, rural isolation, a drift to Dublin, a sense of being neglected. I mean, these are all very familiar themes in Mayo and across rural Ireland, particularly on the western seaboard. You were telling me that you've been out on the campaign trail in recent days, and that while these issues have always made people angry, they're angrier this time.
Yeah, people are very angry on the ground. I just happened to be campaigning yesterday just to do an article for the Mayo News with Saoirse McHugh. And people are angry. And what you hear on the doorsteps is, I'm not going to vote for any one of the big two. When you ask people what are the issues, they'll say, number one is health. I'm looking at a Mayo News online poll, the local newspaper, online poll. Health has 25% of the votes, almost double the next one, which is housing, environment, taxes, rural services and pension. And you might ask, what about housing in Mayo? There's no housing problem. Well, there are people on the housing list. And housing and homelessness, I suppose, are interlinked. And especially people in Mayo, we're all angry over the national homelessness issue. We feel part of that embarrassment, and people on the streets are embarrassed and they're angry over this. But going back to health, yes, health is the big one in Mayo. And if you're asking, what's the problem in Mayo? Well, last Friday there were 37 people on trolleys at the Mayo University Hospital here in Castlebar. And then people have to travel, as you say, go to North West Mayo. The travel to Castlebar can take them an hour and a half. If they have an onward journey to Galway, to a hospital in Galway, which is the main centre, they have another hour and a half. It will be faster for you to travel from Galway to Dublin than it will be from Northwest Mayo into Galway.
Theresa O'Malley, if people are angry about health, and they have said that to us in the past in previous elections as well, and yet they've re-elected the same parties, Mayo being a very, very typical example, where the same two parties have won seats, perhaps not in the same numbers, over and over again. Is that likely to happen this time too?
It's likely to happen in the sense that, I'd say even a week ago, people would say, well, Mayo looks fairly obvious, two Fine Gael, two Fianna Fáil, the traditional return. You could argue poster gates and a few things might have mattered whether which of those candidates. But I would definitely say, like Leamy has said, there is our experience on the street is that people are angry, and they're angry and there's a mood for change. Now, whether that will be reflected on Saturday, 8th of February, remains to be seen. But I'd go even a step further than what Leamy said there was when you ask people, what would you say to someone who knocks on your door for a vote? I'm not voting for any of them, is the response we're getting often. So while there's definitely a mood for change, if it doesn't actually get to the ballot box, well, then we won't see that change.
Where do you see the four seats going?
Well, I mean, it's really difficult to call, and I think everyone sees the first two, and that's the, which is in a way exactly contradicts what we've just said.
Yes.
But Michael Ring will probably, you know, pull in beautifully there at the top, and yet he is part of the present government. But you know, Michael Ring has to the people of Mayo looks like he delivered, so he looks safe, as does Dara Cleary for Fianna Fáil. And then because it's such a big geographical spread, Mayo as well, your location in a constituency like
it's
this,
a huge constituency, yes.
It's very important. So you'd have to say that with Castlebar having a Taoiseach on the last two occasions and getting a huge vote there, that leaves an opening for a Castlebar candidate for sure. And Lisa Chambers already is sitting, and as you say, high profile. But then you also have Alan Dillon, high profile footballer, and replacing Andy Kenny in a way. Whether he can do it or not remains to be seen. And probably part, the biggest part of his you know, competition is within his own party, and that's Michelle Mulhern, who's in Ballina. Then you also have, and with the Sinn Féin general boost in the nationwide, you have Senator Rose Conway Walsh, who already has a good standing in Mayo. And if Mayo is in the mood for change, and if Mayo does change, then you would have to be looking there with Saoirse from the Greens, who's old, their party also on the lift.
Let's see if Mayo is going to change. Teresa, Martin, Liamy and Tom, thank you all very much for coming into us this morning.
Brian Finn joins us with a business update.
Rachel, thank you. Global markets are being hit as the authorities in China warn that the spread of the coronavirus would likely accelerate. Brent crude prices dipped below $60 a barrel for the first time this year. Japanese markets closed 2% lower. Stock markets in China and Hong Kong were shut for the Lunar New Year holiday. European stocks have opened lower this morning too. They're down around 1.5% across the board. Travel and luxury stocks are being particularly badly hit. Shares in Air France KLM are down around 5%. China has banned tour groups from travelling overseas. Swiss food giant Nestle is bulking up its presence in the medical nutrition business. It's acquiring the product Zenpep from Allergan for an undisclosed figure. Zenpep is a product for people whose pancreases don't provide enough enzymes to properly digest fats, proteins and sugars. On the currency markets, the euro is trading at $1.10 and 84.4 pence sterling.
A big weekend of sport, especially in football and hurling, including that brilliant Kerry Dublin game on Saturday. But Darren Frell, the sporting headlines around the world dominated this morning by the death of a superstar.
Yeah, absolutely, Gavin. Kobe Bryant has transcended sport, really, in what he's done in basketball. And tributes, as you say, being paid to him from all around the world, from all different parts of life, whether it be music, sport, entertainment, really a global superstar. One of nine people killed in a helicopter crash. He was 41 and his daughter, who was also on that flight, was just 13. Look at what he's achieved on the court. Five-time NBA champion, played for the LA Lakers throughout his 20-year career, face of the NBA, in fact, for two decades. And I guess one stat, with all those victories in terms of titles, look at what he achieved. He was on the All-Star team 18 of those 20 seasons. I think that pretty sums up his consistency as well. Let's hear from Mike DiGiovanna, sports writer for the LA Times, and he says that Kobe Bryant made an instant impact upon leaving high school.
He was 17, I think, when he was drafted and, you know, went straight to the NBA. He was one of the first to really come out of high school and be an impact player and lead the Lakers to championships within the first couple of years. And great as he was on the court, so many amazing skills offensively, defensively, I think. What really set him apart was his work ethic, his just incredible desire to win and his intensity. And I think that elevated the play of his teammates all throughout the year. He just would not accept losing or anything less than, you know, 100% effort. And he really set an example for his teammates and the whole city, you know. They really rallied around that kind of attitude.
Yeah, very sad news indeed from the US last night. Kilestra have won the Hula Hoops Women's National Cup Final, beating Brunel by 82 points to 59 last night at Tala Stadium. Mark Leishman has won the Farmers Insurance Open on 15 under par. Rory McIlroy, as we know, was bidding to become the world number one, regained that position and just came up short in his bid to win that tournament. Three shots back on 12 under par, tied for third place overall. In Gaelic games, Waterford, Galway, Clare and Kilkenny, winners in Division 1 of the Alliance Hurling League. And we were reflecting on the hurling in the last hour on this programme, but let's turn our attention to the Gaelic football now. And Oisín McConville joins me on the line. Oisín, I think the big talking point heading into this weekend was the mark. And believe it or not, the world didn't end. How do you reflect on the mark and the opening weekend in the Alliance Football League?
What was all the fuss about, Darren?
Exactly,
I just think that, you know, I suppose, having looked at what went on at the weekend, I would say that, you know, the advance mark and all the furore that went with it, it passed off really without any major incident. I think we still have to take a watching brief on it, but I think so far so good in that regard.
Okay, I'm sure we're going to be talking about it in the coming weeks. In terms of the play and the teams, was there any one performance or one team that really, impressed you over the weekend?
Yeah, well, there was lots of teams that impressed me. I think the quality, you know, of the football was extraordinary at the weekend, considering we're still in January. The fitness levels, you know, have gone through the roof, and, you know, it just shows how professional Gaelic games has got at this level. And as I say, especially so early in the season, you look at the performances of Brian Fenton and Kieran Kilkenny in the Dublin Kerry match. And then, of course, David Clifford steals the limelight because, you know, I mean, you talk about quality. I mean, like, this guy has everything. They talked about the captaincy weighing heavy on the shoulders, and he steps up with that last-minute free. So, I mean, you know, it's early in the season to be talking about the likes of him, but, again, you know, just extreme quality in everything that he does, and it was a real standout performance on Saturday night.
I think there's real interest, Oisín, in all four divisions in the football this season, given what's coming down the line in terms of the two-tier championship. But there was a significant result in Division 4 yesterday, an important one of that for Sligo and London. Tell us why.
Yeah, well, Sligo haven't won in 18 months, and they managed to get over the line. You know, they were obviously impressive in the fact that they scored 5-9 in the game, and it just signals, you know, a lot of intent. I'm sure there's a lot of heart in that camp, so I think just for today, the word of mention, because, you know, it's that'll give them huge confidence, and as I say, just that monkey off the back of not having won in 18 months.
Yeah, I'm sure they're pretty happy about that this morning. Oisín McConville, thanks for joining us here on Morning Ireland. Elsewhere in the Little National Football League, wins for Waterford, Mayo, Dublin and Tipperary drew. Sláinte Níl will meet Sarsfields in the AIB All-Ireland Club Camogie final, and I think two deserved victories there. That final will be live on Sunday Sport early next month, so we're looking forward to covering that particular match. On the soccer front, Manchester City and Manchester United progressed to the fifth round of the FA Cup, but Shrewsbury held Liverpool to a 2-2 draw. And finally, the Australian Open quarterfinals, well, they're taking shape. Simona Halep, Garbine Muguruza, Stan Wawrinka and Dominic Thiem, they've all qualified for the last eight. That match between Nick Kyrgios and Rafael Nadal is just underway. Very early days yet. Last time I checked before I came in, it was going to serve in that particular match.
Let's stay with health. A leading patient advocate has resigned from the HSE board. Mark Molloy was appointed by the Minister for Health, Simon Harris, in January last year, along with several other members. Mark and Roisin Molloy's son Mark died shortly after birth at the Midland Regional Hospital in Portlaoise in 2012, and their case contributed to the major review into babies' deaths at the hospital. We're joined now by our health correspondent, Fergal Bowers. Morning, Fergal. What do we know about this resignation?
Well, the appointment of patient advocates to the HC board was a recommendation by Dr. Gabriel Scally in his report on cervical check. So Mark Molloy was such an appointment to ensure the HC board would have members with patient advocacy experience. Now, Mark Molloy tendered his resignation to the Minister for Health, Simon Harris, from the HC board on the 7th of January. And a statement we've received on behalf of Mark and Roisin to RTE says that it was a difficult decision to become a member of the HSE board, given the couple's experiences with the HSE since baby Mark died in 2012, and it was especially a very difficult decision to resign from the board. But however, not having had a veto on significant board decisions that the couple had an issue with, given the in-depth knowledge they had of the workings of the HSE, the Molloys and Mark Molloy obviously were, by extension, they felt being complicit in the decisions. But going into the detail, I think, of of the actual issues due to confidentiality of being on a statutory board.
The appointment of patient advocates to the HSE board is a recent development. How did it come about?
Well, it arose principally through the Dr. Gabriel Scally's work and the importance of having people on a board. I mean, these are voluntary, unpaid positions that people like Mark and others give so much of their own time to. Now, in a statement, the HSE said Mark Molloy confirmed to the chair of the HSE board on the 7th of January he had tendered his resignation to the Minister for Health, and the HSE said the chairman would like to thank Mark for his dedication, hard work and insightful input into the important work of the HSE board since it was established 7 months ago. These are difficult times for patient advocates. You'll recall that last year, a cervical check campaigner and 221 Plus member, Lorraine Walsh, resigned as a patient advocate from the cervical check steering group at the Department of Health in a clash with the Department of Health. And now we have Mark Molloy's departure from the HSE board. So there are serious issues involved.
Has the HSE had anything to say about this development?
Well, they've confirmed the resignation and thanked Mark for certainly all his work. Now, Mark and Roisin say patients have a pivotal role in the design and governance of the health service. Their aim was always to act in the interests of patients, and they felt the integrity that they'd built up over the past 8 years in their various campaigning would be eroded by a continued involvement on the board. And obviously, while Mark Molloy has resigned from the HSE board, the couple say they'll continue to work from the outside to achieve their objectives, and also through Roisin Molloy's involvement on the Sláinte Care Advisory Council.
Fergal, thank you. That's our health correspondent, Fergal Bowers. It's 8:57.
The number of people killed in China by the coronavirus has risen to at least 80, with almost 3,000 confirmed ill. The National New Year holiday has been extended by 3 days in an attempt to contain the spread. And the head of the World Health Organization is travelling to Beijing today to meet Chinese officials. Christian Lindmeier is a spokesperson for the WHO and joins us now on the line. Thanks for taking our call this morning. What sort of advice is the WHO now issuing to China?
Thanks for having me. So China is definitely doing the best it can with strong measures to protect their population as good as they think. That's, of course, the sovereign responsibility of every member state of the World Health Organization. Our director general in the larger team is actually, as you just indicated, meeting the officials over the next days there, and they will certainly discuss steps further. But while the important steps are for, of course, a country and for health authorities to take measures, there's individual measures everyone can take which go a long way. And that's simple flu and cold hygiene, meaning you protect yourself the same way you do with someone who has a strong cold, a strong flu. You don't get too close. Pay attention. They don't sneeze or whatever in your face. If you've been in touch with them, you hand sanitize afterwards. And if yourself you're sick, you pay attention that you sneeze maybe into your elbow or into a tissue and discard the tissue. So simple measures for self-protection, which go a long as we don't have a cure or anything further for this new virus.
One of the issues here is the fact that, as you say, this is a new virus. How much is now known about it, and are there still a lot of unanswered questions?
Correct. So it is, we know that it is out of a family of coronaviruses. There are a couple of viruses which go into this, and it's very much related to the flu. So here we go. This is a good similarity. We know that the symptoms can be very mild or very strong, which is also a bit of a problem because people can have mild symptoms and don't immediately realize they have the virus and could pass it on because the incubation period is somewhere around up to 10 days. On the other hand, many people come out of this disease because, of course, they only had mild symptoms and they recover even by themselves or with a little treatment against a sore throat or a headache or whatever. But, of course, those with stronger symptoms, they have to be looked at by medical authorities. They have to maybe hospitalized or even given stronger treatment. So the whole range is there. But of course, because it is flu-like, many people go also with normal respiratory problems now to doctors. But that is good. And because so many go to the medical authorities, that's why we see more and more cases.
China is a huge country. I mean, the population is reckoned to be, what, about 1.4 billion people. When you consider that figure, I mean, the numbers affected here, they sound very small. So is there a danger that we could get this out of context?
Well, it's an interesting point you're making there. But of course, the biggest issue here is that it's a virus which is new, and we don't yet know how it behaves fully. Again, we know a lot of things, as we just said, but there are also a lot of things we're not quite aware of yet. We don't fully know how it continues to spread, how easily it spreads. We have an indication because, for example, those travelers who left China and showed up in other countries and were actually detected there, they have not, to the best of our knowledge, yet passed this virus on to, let's say, contacts they met on the way, be it the taxi driver, the clerk at the airline counter, the family members, whoever. So it doesn't seem to be spreading that easy. And these details have to be looked at very, very much, very closely right now to see what the behavior of this new virus is and as a consequence, how we best attack it.
You've spoken to us about the advice the WHO has given to China, and you said that you were satisfied at the moment that enough was being done to try and halt the spread of the virus. What about other countries? What are you saying to them?
This is a little test, or not even a little, it is a test for health systems right now, because detecting a case early is of importance, and then isolating them as good as possible and treating them, of course, in the best ways possible. And further looking at the contacts they have met on the way, family members, monitoring them, checking on them, and seeing if anybody develops symptoms. So detecting cases early is of utmost importance. That could be done through simple temperature screenings, which of course don't detect everyone immediately, because if you have mild symptoms, you may not have a fever. But people who have flu-like symptoms, they should check with their health authorities. And again, these are the best preventive measures we have, and these are the best preventive measures we have right now.
And when we see stories like those emerging this morning, say I'm looking at a Reuters report talking about Malaysia imposing a temporary ban on Chinese nationals from the city of Wuhan, saying that they basically can't come into Malaysia, is that appropriate?
These are very strong measures, and WHO typically, the World Health Organization typically does not recommend travel and trade bans, because in our days and times, the virus travels easy in many, many different ways and forms. So this is, again, something, of course, national authorities will do the best what they think is good for their citizens. But we always recommend looking at measures like this and try to reevaluate. And if you have to put them in force, try to limit it to a short period possible in order to not put too much strain on your population.
Christian Lindmeier from the World Health Organization, thank you for taking our call. It's 12 minutes to nine, and we'll be returning to Castlebar in just a moment.
As we were discussing with Tom Leamy Martin and Teresa earlier here in Castlebar, and with one of the worst emergency department trolley counts in the country at the local hospital, just across the road from us here at the TF Royal Hotel in the town, an ageing population and surging waiting lists, health is one of the biggest issues for voters in Mayo. Our reporter Fiacra O'Kioni heard some of the views of constituents.
Health is crazy now, yeah, with the hospitals and people waiting on trolleys and that, like, it is, it's cruel.
Your grandmother's 88, just got diagnosed with stomach cancer, and she actually left the hospital because she didn't want to stay on a trolley.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It's crazy. 88 years of age on a trolley.
Health, really, that's waiting lists everywhere are as bad, but they're quite bad down here. Like,
do you think politicians are listening to those concerns? Because obviously those concerns have been raised for a number of years. But the issue is still there.
We all think we could fix the health service. I know this, and they're too top heavy with managers. Less of the frontline. They need more frontline and less pencil pushers.
Oh, I think health very much so. There's very lacking in employing nurses and everything.
In terms of health, what specifically do you guys feel is not being addressed in health? Is it concerns about the hospital and access to it, or is it concerned about waiting lists, or is there anything
else? It's the waiting list in the hospital. I mean, your general hospital, I believe, is the third worst in the country at the minute. It is also, you see, because of Roscommon closing at one time, most of the departments in Roscommon, they're taking the overflow into Castlebar, which isn't equipped whatsoever to deal with that. So that is a big issue, the overcrowding as well in Mayo General Hospital.
So I think it's disgraceful that people have to be on trolleys for days, like, and all that.
Actually, look, it's the same issues as everywhere. Health, crime, A&E, overcrowded. A lot more, I think a lot more could be done at community level, you know. 2 weeks will tell it all, won't it?
People in Mayo talking to our reporter Fiacra O'Cunny. The full list of candidates for the election here on Saturday, February the 8th. Dara Cleary, Fianna Fáil, Lisa Chambers, Fianna Fáil, Gerry Loftus, Independent, Rose Conway, Walsh, Sinn Féin, Saoirse McHugh, Green Party, Paul Lawless, Aintu, Michael Ring, Fine Gael, Michelle Mulhern, Fine Gael, Alan Dillon, Fine Gael, Sean Forkin, Independent, Dahi O'Fallowine, Irish Freedom Party, Joe Daly, Solidarity, People Before Profit, Camel Uddin, Labour, Gráinne de Barra, Independent, and Stephen Manning, Independent.